from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Okay, tell me your name and what do you do?
Elliot.
Smith, I play music.
I went to college at Hampshire College, which is in Amherst, Massachusetts, and it's one of these real progressive liberal colleges that came out of the 60s with no tests, no grades, no credits, and everything at our school was a little different, including the orientation. So instead of doing a traditional orientation, you had the option to come up a week early before school actually started and go on a trip. And there were many options. You could go on a kayaking trip in Maine or a rock climbing trip or a vision quest. And I ended up signing up for the week-long backpacking trip in the Green Mountains of Vermont.
You're probably wondering what this story about hippies hiking in the mountains could possibly have to do with Elliot Smith, right? Well, here you go.
It just so happened that Steve Smith also signed up for that trip.
Oh, yeah. So there's a chance you're still wondering what the connection is at this point. Well, here's the deal. Elliot Smith wasn't born Elliot Smith. He became Elliot Smith. And some people don't know that. A lot of people don't know that. But before he was Elliot, his name was, and you might have guessed it at this point, Steve. And that's why we're right here today. I'm Sean Cannon from Louisville Public Media, and the guest list, it's Say Yes, an Elliot Smith podcast. And a big chunk of this episode is about that. Steve becoming Elliot, both figuratively and literally. And it kind of happened during his time at Hampshire College, along with that guy right there, Dan Huckstein. You know, most of the folks I've talked to on Say Yes knew Elliot Smith because of his career as a musician, but not Dan. His context began and ended in college. That is, until years later, when he found out that Elliot had become an accomplished musician. In fact, I actually knew Dan before this, but only as a local restaurateur in Louisville. And I accidentally found out about his history at Hampshire and his history with Elliot after starting this project. So for me, it was kind of a weird connection to make. But anyway, back to the story of Dan and Elliot, or Steve, at this point, hiking in the mountains.
So we met, and that day, eight of us, including Steve, backpacked for a week together throughout the Green Mountains of Vermont. So we got to know each other really well. And it was a way that, being an alternative college and into very experiential education, that instead of just showing up, not knowing anybody and going to your dorm room, you spent a week intensively with some random people that a lot of those people became our good friends throughout college. You know, there were, I think, on the trip, four guys, four girls, and then it was led by a couple older students. So it was all students on the trip, and the older students had, and they had all the gear for us, backpacks. So the first experience is where we meet each other, we're saying hello, and of course, back then, this is in 1987, fall of 1987, we all had long hair. We were all heading off to this hippie college in Western Massachusetts, and the first thing we had to do was get all of our gear, fit our backpacks, get all of our sleeping bags, camp stoves, all of that gear together. And then we went on the trip. They took us in a van up there and dropped us off in one location. And we were going to be picked up basically about 40 miles away after backpacking for a week. One of my very first impressions is one of the camp counselors, one of the older students, he brought a guitar with him. So first night, we get a fire going. We all start sitting by the fire, and he starts playing Grateful Dead songs and lots of camp songs, John Prine and whatnot. And we're all singing along. And then Steve Elliott says, "Well, I play a little guitar. Can I play?" "Sure." So he takes the guitar and starts strumming and playing, and he starts singing songs. And all of us were mesmerized. I mean, he was already that talented. He was, I think he turned 18 on that, actually on that backpacking trip, because I believe his birthday was right there at the end of August. But he started playing, and we're looking at each other like, what is this? And finally we said, what song was that? We never heard that. He said, oh, I wrote that. And then we started talking, and everyone was already amazed. You could see how talented the guy was. And he was a great guy, kind of quiet. On that trip, we got to know each other well. He really enjoyed the outdoors and enjoyed the hiking. But, of course, every night the rest of the trip, everybody made, you know, Steve had to play guitar for us. And then we found out that he had actually been in a band back in Portland, Oregon in high school that was called Stranger Than Fiction. And I remember he gave me a tape. I wish I still had that old cassette tape. I'd love to track down some of those songs that he wrote way back when he was in high school. Dogs and dogs and dogs jump through you. There's some rain inside the house. Come on, please, but I don't wanna live here. I'll be here. It's all we got. Yeah. You know, we the first couple years of Hampshire, we hung out a lot. We had another friend of mine who his name is John Spiker, but we all know him as Spike. And a friend of ours, Mitch. Mitch and Spike lived on the hall right below him in the dorms. We'd go up to his room a lot and hang out. I used to go up there and he'd sit and play guitar and play music. And he was always just really generous. He always looked at other people as having more talent than him. He wanted to get me to sing along with him or get one of the other guys. He was teaching him how to play guitar. He was just a very modest guy. And we looked at him like, wow, you've got an unbelievable amount of talent. And in fact, he was in a couple classes with me. I remember he was in physiology with me, and he told me, I want to be a doctor. That was his, he was, I guess, sort of pre-med. And I even remember saying to him, you've got so much talent with music. Oh, I'm, you know, that's just something I like to do. And he was kind of like a lot of us. He was still thinking of what career he was going to do, and not really, at that time, I think music was just a hobby. But one of the really interesting stories I have about Steve is he was in a class called Crime and Punishment with me, which we started by reading Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, and then it was sort of a criminal justice course. It was taught by a professor, Lester Mazur, who's an attorney, and one of the projects I did for it, we had something called divisions, and they were basically like a big term paper. You spent a large, almost a semester working on these different projects. And my project was studying prison overcrowding. And there was a prison in Springfield, Massachusetts that was very overcrowded to the point where the inmates were sleeping in hallways and they had cots in the gym. And there were just so many issues that I set up an arrangement to go down there and interview correctional officers and inmates and whatnot. And I'll just call him Elliot for the sake of the show. But Elliot looked at me and said, I'd like to go with you. And I said, really? You know, I can't imagine any of my friends wanting to go with me to this prison, but I was just so happy that somebody was going to go with me. So he and I took a Peter Pan bus down to Springfield, Massachusetts, and spent the day at a prison. And I think that was kind of just the way he was. That was maybe the writer in him, that he just liked to experience anything. He looked at me like, well, hopefully it's the only time I experience the inside of a prison. But, you know, he just went down there and spent the day with me and went along with me. And I was just glad to have somebody go with me. And because it wasn't his project, it was mine. But then, those first couple of years, he went to a lot of parties with us. We had a lot of fun. We hung out a lot. But he started, I guess as time went on, first of all, he formed a band on campus with another guy, Neil Gust, who went on to do a lot of things. I believe he helped engineer several of his early albums. They were in Heat Miser together. And Neil and him formed a duet called Swimming Jesus. And they played in our Bridge Cafe once a week. And then as they got bigger, I think they played in the Red Barn on campus. And they played at different venues around the campus. So we'd go see him a lot. He and more and more, though, as you know, going into like our third and fourth year of college, he started to, I guess I'd say he became so involved in his music, he started to kind of withdraw and isolate himself. And it almost became where if I wanted to hang out with him, I had to go seek him out. He was always happy to have us around. I think he liked us as much as anybody. But he really got to the point where I think he almost preferred to be alone, just engrossed in his music. And you know, we looked at him, you know, remember, we're 18, 19 years old, and our interest is partying and chasing girls and all that. And here this guy, Elliot, every girl there on campus would throw themselves at him because he could play guitar and sing magnificently, and he just wanted nothing to do with that.
Concrete hands picked up the telephone ring. Do you know who you're talking to? No, and I don't care who. She whispered quiet terror.
He was living in the basement of one of the, we call them mods. The campus is filled with student apartments, so everybody lived in their own apartment with kitchens and roommates.
You remember when Dan mentioned his other buddy, Mitch, who used to hang out with Elliot? Well, this is Mitch Kramer.
Elliot, now he's Elliot at this point. He's changed his name, which is, of course, you know, something we all made fun of him for. But he was creating this really interesting music with an 8-track in this basement room he had. I remember, like, trying to convince him to get out of the basement, but he loved it down there. And he was creating all the music himself. He was laying down his own background tracks and creating drum beats on a early computer. I don't think most of us had computers at this point. And playing all the music. And I thought it was the most interesting thing I had ever seen. I didn't even know what an 8-track was when I got to college. And I would go and watch Elliot make these musics, usually smoking weed or some other sort of thing. That was always the excuse for going and visiting him, was because, you know, it was college. So I would, like, you know, roll a joint and take it over to his basement, and he would play me this music, and he would show me how he made it, and our friend Spike. And that was our excuse to sort of see him create his Div 3. And of course, as anybody who knows his music knows, especially his early music, it's just the saddest music ever, which is why it's so amazing.
The Div 3, by the way, is basically your senior thesis at Hampshire. And as you can tell, Elliot's senior thesis, his Div 3, was an album. You know, some of that material actually ended up on Roman Candles, so you can start to think of this as the birth of Elliot Smith in a very real way. So now we go from some folks who met Elliot Smith before he was Elliot Smith to someone who, to this day, still regrets not meeting him at all. That's Ben Gibbard of the Postal Service and Death Cab for Cutie, who happened to discover Elliot Smith's music during Death Cab's embryonic stages. I'm talking the very beginning.
Chris Walla, formerly of Death Cab for Cutie, played me the second album when we first kind of started hanging out in like 1996 or so. And you know, I, like many people, when the first time I heard him, you know, it just felt like he was filling a massive void in the, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, like singer songwriter genre. Because it was clear to me in those recordings, you know, this is one of the first people that at least I had heard that was, you know, writing songs from the perspective of someone who clearly grew up with, you know, 80s punk rock and you know, it was coming out of a certain kind of a world that, you know, singer-songwriters to that point, at least to me, didn't seem to come out of. I mean, you know, songwriters tend to be kind of easy breezy, you know, a lot of the Asylum Records era singer-songwriters, not a lot of which I love very much, but, you know, just, you know, kind of, you know, some really great songs from that era, but also, you know, fairly light in subject matter. And, you know, I was just struck with just the tone of his songwriting, the brutal honesty and just, you know, the imagery that he kind of wove into his songs was, you know, a palette that I had not really heard, you know, in any other songwriters, to that point. But also it was clear that he loved the Beatles, you know, and so, I mean, I was hooked immediately. And then, you know, it seemed like Either Or came out, you know, not that much longer, you know, yeah, I guess that's 97. So, you know, yeah, at that point I had, like, you know, was started to come, you know, listen to more Heat Miser and, you know, the Roman Candle, the first record, which I loved. And when Either Or came out, it just felt like, you know, even as a, you know, 20, 21 year old at that point, it just felt like a really important record, like an important record with a capital I. And, you know, it was kind of jaw-dropping to see just, you know, the response to that album as it unfolded, not only in our, you know, music head communities, but also as it kind of made its way into the mainstream via Goodwill Hunting.
Someone's always coming around here, trailing some new kill. Says I seen your picture on a $100 bill. What's a game of chance to you?
I had a summer job in 1997 where I had to be at work at 6 a.m. every morning, and it was about a half hour drive north of Bellingham where we were living at the time. And, you know, I was writing the first album at that point. And I listened to Either Or like every day on the way up to work. Every day I listened to Either or Roman Candle. And, you know, I just, you know, listening to these albums, you know, it was like, it cemented in my mind what I wanted to do with my life. And I think because of that, and because of how they mark time in my life, those records will always be, my favorite of his albums. I don't necessarily think that all four of those first four albums are necessarily the best albums, but they certainly mean much more to me than the later material, not because the later material is lacking in any way, but because of where I was in my life and what, you know, where the path upon which those albums sent me on.
I can make you satisfied in everything you do. All your secret wishes could right now be coming true. Be forever with my poison on.
As I mentioned earlier, Ben never did get to meet Elliott Smith, but it did almost happen once.
I suppose I had an opportunity in 1998. We were playing a show at EJ's in Portland. It was one of our, we were doing this short tour down the West Coast in support of our first album, and we were playing a show at, like, as I said, EJ's, Sean from Cracker Bash's new band was headlining the show, and Elliott and Janet Weiss came to the show together. Now, I've, you know, since become friends with Janet, but at the time, you know, this was mind blowing to me to see two of, in my world, the biggest rock stars ever, you know, walking into a show that I was going to play. And I knew that they weren't probably there to see our band play, because I knew the connection to Sean. And, you know, Elliott, it was, this is 98, it's the December of 98. And, you know, this is at the, this is peak Good Will Hunting, you know, Oscar level Elliott Smith. And, you know, there were just a lot of people who saw them there, him there, and he was at the bar and just trying to drink. And people were kind of, I wouldn't say harassing him, but kind of coming up to him and patting him on the back, trying to buy him drinks. And I just felt like if I were to have gone up to him in that context, I would have just been another one of those people, and that my admiration for him would not come through in the way that I really wanted it to. And also I was, what, 21, 22 years old. I was nervous, I was so nervous to be in a room with this guy and to think that he was going to hear my songs, you know. So, you know, I didn't take that opportunity. And, you know, as the years, you know, progressed from there and, you know, up until his death in 2003, you know, it seemed like, you know, we were going to end up in the same room at some point because we had so many mutual friends. But alas, it never happened.
Last but not least this week on Say Yes, we've got a few comments from Matthew Kaz of Not a Surf, who Elliott opened for on tour. Wrongfully, though, according to Matthew, since in his mind, Not a Surf deserved to be the ones opening for Elliott, and for a whole host of reasons. And here are just a couple of them from Matthew.
I feel very grateful to him because I feel like he opened up a kind of a new introspection or something, a new braver kind. And I'm sure he didn't reinvent the wheel, and I'm sure his kind of songwriting has, I'm sure there are antecedents, you know, precedents. But it felt new, still does, kind of vulnerable and proud at the same time. And there's a lot of that happy, sad sort of contradiction in there. But maybe it's not maybe that's not a contradiction, or maybe that's the lesson too. You know, that you can contain a lot of moods at once and they don't cause each other or solve each other or contradict each other or cancel each other out. I felt that in him too, being like kind of a cheerful, jolly person and singing pretty sad songs. I think the other thing about Elliott Smith that's so powerful is, aside from how the songs were written and the quality of the hooks and the incredible writing, but he was such a phenomenal guitar player, just out of sight. And that's another part of the ballsiness, is that you knew you were in the hands of somebody who had put in a lot of hard work, which might have been all joyful. I'm sure didn't feel like work to him, but you know, he really put in the time to become an extraordinary guitar player. And that was really something, that kind of like guitar sounding like a whole, you know, like a whole band, not rhythmically, but just in terms of like entertainment. You know, when you saw him play by himself, you weren't wishing there was a rhythm section there. You were completely satisfied. It was all there. You know, the kind of internal motion, you know, sort of two voices happening at once. I mean, on the guitar, you know, like a lot of harmony, a lot of movement. kind of like Bert Jansch a little bit, you know, in his way, without Bert Jansch without fingernails, basically.
That's all we've got for you this time on Say Yes, an Elliott Smith podcast, produced by Louisville Public Media and The Guest List in conjunction with Kill Rock Stars. Special thanks to Portia Sabin, Stacey Owen, Stephen George, Andy High, and Margaret Darling. Thanks as well to Dan Huckstein, Mitch Kramer, Benjamin Gibbard, and Matthew Cause for talking with us this week. And thanks to Joshua Piper for that beautiful piano version of Between the Bars. As always, though, most of all, thanks to Elliott Smith for making every bit of this possible through his music. I'm Sean Cannon. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Sean Cannon. And you can subscribe to The Guest List at wfpk.org/guestlist or wherever you get your podcasts. I'll see you next week. Say yes.
He sang with such confidence. I mean, I so distinctly remember him playing and singing better than everyone else. And everybody was a musician. There were tons of great musicians, tons of great actors. And some people shone, and he was better. And without question, as a 20-year-old, part of his better was confidence. He had confidence as a musician. That's what I remember.